Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Yes, we begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman as he testified before the impeachment hearing in the fall of 2019. Every passing day, not only do I think of Colonel Vindman, but I keep thinking about the fact that he felt so secure in telling his dad it would be all right. And as we've come to expect, with Donald Trump as president, so little is all right. Now the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, I went back to my favorite source, theconversation.com. I mind theconversation.com probably more than any other radio talk show host in America. And the reason I do it is that it takes me in places I need to go, because while we can talk about COVID-19 and while we can talk about testing and while we can talk about Donald Trump and his tweets, there is so much more we need to understand as we move through this very perilous time, and that we look at a very, very important election that will be happening in November of 2020. But part of that important election is who is going to vote. And this is not a conversation about voter suppression. This is not a conversation about mail-in voting. It's a conversation about actually encouraging young people to participate in an election. So the article at theconversation.com was entitled, How to Reach Young Voters When They're Stuck at Home. Joining me right now is Zabi Issa, the Director of Impact at Circle at Tufts University. I recognize Tufts. So walk me through Impact and walk me through Circle so people will understand why you wrote this piece and why it's totally appropriate for you to be focusing on this issue. And it will give us a better sense of how what your words are telling us is based on the experience that you have gleaned over the course of years, sort of talking to groups and young people around the country.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Arnie. So I work at an applied research center called Circle. We are a research center that's part of the Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts University, one of the only colleges in the country focused on civic life. And in addition to Tufts' interest in civic engagement as an institution, we're also investing our time in our research on understanding how to strengthen democracy. And so Circle's mission, and Circle started back in 2001, is to really use research as a tool to understand how to increase, diversify, and sustain young people's civic and political engagement. So we've been doing so for two decades. And one of the lessons that we've learned, both in our research and others, is that so often our issues are not about youth apathy, they're about youth access. And so a lot of our research focuses on the structures that are intended to support civic engagement and small d democratic participation, and how we can shift negative influences to be more positive. So as Director of Impact, my job is to think about, how do we leverage this research to work with other people who care about this? How do we make sure that the research questions that we're asking are informed by what's happening on the ground and are practical to increasing, diversifying, and sustaining youth civic and political engagement?
So I'm the daughter of two public school teachers from New York. My father used to give me a current events quiz every single Monday that he would give to his high school students, even when I was 5 and 6 years old.
That's amazing.
Okay. My father would take me in to the voting booth from the time I was an infant. Voting was, I just assumed that was what you were supposed to do. It was like eating. Okay. And so as a result, I became very active as a child, even at age 15 with the, at that time, my parents were very conservative Republicans, but I joined the Young Democrats. I had to be counterculture. And, you know, I would be leafleting at the Long Island Railroad and I couldn't even vote, but I knew that I cared about school board votes. And so I became aware. And so obviously it was no question that I would be voting when it was appropriate for me to vote. And so I saw voting not only as something that was fed to me, but it was also reinforced in school. Mm-hmm. So that school was a place where you talked about current events. School was a place where you did mock elections. School was a place where you also were almost had the expectation that upon graduation, that voting was part of that coming of age. Now let's fast forward to 2020, maybe even 2018, 2016. It's a little more provocative in the public education system. Some people see civic education not as embracing democracy and encouraging people to participate, but they see it having another agenda, mm-hmm. that you are somehow manipulating children, that somehow giving them the facts and teaching them about why the franchise is so important is a way to maybe encourage them to get to a certain outcome. Because the perception is, and I learned this from my Speaker of the House in New Hampshire, that young people vote liberally and democratically. Therefore, to a large extent, if you can create an impediment to their participation, it might benefit his party. Well, that means that what you do is perceived as having an agenda as opposed to part of an educational process to encourage people to understand that democracy begins probably not only at birth, but that when you begin to participate by voting, you really become what I think citizenship is supposed to be about, which is that level of participation. So as you look at the organization you work with, how are you seeing different states responding to the work you do? Whether you're getting reinforcers in schools or whether you're getting barriers in school? And now, given the fact that, as you point out, they're stuck at home, now the question becomes, how do you reach them when it isn't necessarily through an academic setting, but it may be through a home where, unlike Arnie Arneson, who had parents that basically insisted that the franchise was something she needed to be knowledgeable about, they may also be somewhat disconnected from that participation and that civic engagement.
Your story really exemplifies so much of what we try to highlight and point out to people, that a young person's environment, that a young person's, the people who are around a young person have such a strong influence on whether or not that young person believes in themselves, believes that they have a voice that matters, and whether or not they see concrete opportunities. And so what we've found over the past two decades, and other researchers have found as well, is that what we could call inputs or we could call conditions differ so dramatically amongst young people. Yeah. And it's another one of the inequalities that we can talk about in this country, whether it manifests through schools or, you know, the neighborhood that a young person lives in and the resources that they have for extracurricular time. And all of these things have an effect on young people's likelihood to participate in democracy and to participate in their communities. And so our work is really trying to use independent, rigorous research to highlight these realities and show these differences in access, differences in resources. And we go back to, for so often, the fact that no young person's political voice or ability to have a role in their community should depend on their zip code, their neighborhood, or exactly. their family's background.
Exactly.
And there's amazing work going on in every state across the country when it comes to youth engagement. There are amazing teachers who are making this happen. And one of the myths that we often have to bust is that all young people, as you say, the sort of quote that you used or the stereotype, that all young people are liberal, because that's absolutely not true.
I know.
And it, you know, we can look at the 2016 election as an example. There was over a third of young people who voted for President Trump. And yes, you know, younger generations tend to be a little bit more liberal than older generations. But if you go to different states, it really can differ quite dramatically. There's some states where the plurality of young people voted for President Trump in 2016. And so we really, really have to nuance this conversation just a little bit more before we, you know, continue to trash and blame young people.
So I do these educational things where I talk to the best and brightest, and they're incredible, and you see them as future leaders, and they're very engaged, and I get them so pumped about wanting to be involved in all the political issues, and we cover the gamut. But my frustration is I want to invert the pyramid. I want to speak to kids that aren't in that classroom. I want to speak to kids that aren't competitive like that. I want to speak to kids if they had a tracking in schools, track one, track two, track three. I want to go into track three, okay? And for whatever reason, part of the problem I think we also have is you want to understand what happens in the home. I even want to understand what happens within the academic setting, because again, we tend to put kids in silos. And if we understand that democracy is not about a silo, it's about all of us. I'm wondering, as you've gone around the country and you've looked about bringing young people in, how do we convince the academics and convince the teachers that this is a story and a lesson and an involvement that has to be across the board? You don't have to be going to Harvard or to UNH to think that voting matters. You know, you could be working at Market Basket or Shaw's or a grocery store because it truly matters to you too. And I think that universality has to be impressed upon people when they're 15, 16, and 17, so that not only will they vote when they're 18, but they'll understand that this is about their country.
You know, you have really honed in on a couple of things that we found to be incredibly important, specifically in reference to voting, and which is why we talk about what we call growing voters. And like you just said, this has to start before young people reach 18, Right. Because there's actually so many barriers then and challenges to young people thinking about themselves as a voter and as someone who has a voice that come up even before young people reach 18. So many negative messages, especially amongst young people from marginalized communities and communities of color. And so the earlier we can start, the better. And as you point out, the school is such an important opportunity to reach more and more diverse young people. Because for young people who are going to go on to college, they will likely receive that message and receive some sort of support to become a voter or be around people who are. And our focus a lot has been on K-12 because it can reach young people who are not who are less likely to be involved in an institution after they finish or leave high school.
Well, you know, I want to get into your article because now I want to talk about they're stuck at home. So this is in a lot of ways where this whole point of the raison d'être for this conversation. But I do want to just sort of say something. It is really important to start young. And young doesn't mean high school. And young doesn't even mean junior high. Young means elementary school. And I've told this story before, Ken, you've heard me tell it. I worked at a Girl Scout camp. I was not a Girl Scout, but they hired me anyway. And so I worked at a Girl Scout camp. So thousands of young girls came in from ages 6 to age 15. And I, every day, had a radio show at the Girl Scout camp. It wasn't a real radio show, but we had a mock studio. And we did everything from the local weather report to what was going on at camp. But then I did a segment, or I had someone do a segment called Dan Rather Not with the News. And Dan Rather Not shared the headlines in the news of what was going on in the world outside of camp, okay? What was happening in the UK? What was happening in Washington? Now, that happened every single day at camp. I can tell you how many parents came up to me and said, how does my kid know about this? Mm-hmm. How does my kid know about that? And they're talking about seven-year-olds, okay? And people don't understand that there's a level of curiosity that you can tap. And civics is something that they are curious about, because you can actually connect it to their experience, their lives, their families, what they hear at the kitchen table, and you can expand on it. So I don't know how you have been sort of connecting with people around the country, but gosh, I would start at 5. I would start at 7, because I think it is amazing to me to realize that once you do that, it really does change how they evolve as a young person, whether they're going into an academic track or not. And I think it changes how they hear and see things.
Well, you know, this is coincidental that you're bringing this up, because our amazing director, Kay Kawashima Ginsberg, just had the opportunity to work with WGBH to produce some, to help support some episodes of Arthur that have civic themes, to do just what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. So you're talking about when they're stuck at home. So tell me, what are you recommending now that so many schools are out? We're not sure whether they're going to go back in the fall. They're trying to do some kind of remote learning, but again, that is about access to the internet and access to a computer. So remote learning is very, very uneven. So what are you recommending?
Well, first and foremost, we are recommending that people realize that these messages can come from a lot of sources. In the amazing youth engagement year of 2018, where youth turnout, you know, tripled in some places, it was huge. We saw young people hearing about elections from a wide range of sources. For some young people, it was their friends. From some young people, the most young people, it was family. And, you know, all across the board. And so for both young people and others, I think it's really thinking about who are you entrusting relationships with and you can talk to about elections? Who can you bring this up with? Because trust is a real core issue when it comes to information about elections. So there are many people who can act to help support young people right now. The second thing is that basic information is really key. Information about how to register to vote, information about who you can reach out to and support in that process, and the same about the voting process, right? Just like school is up in the air, so are voting processes in many states, right? Are people going to lean on vote by mail? Are people going to, you know, do you have to have a witness signature for your absentee ballot? All of these different things are up in the air right now. And so young people who are new to the system are going to need even more support to understand where to go to find out this information, right? And that is key to come from a number of sources as well, right? Because if you're a new voter, you may not know that the, you know, Board of Elections office exists, right? Or the what the website is.
And yeah, so, exactly.
And so, you know, that's why, you know, family members, friends, people who are in, you know, online groups together can share this information, because getting it more than once is a good thing. And it's very important for a couple of very specific reasons. One is, you know, as you've said, there's some young people who are going to figure this out for themselves because they care about politics, they care about elections.
Right.
But there's some young people who haven't been exposed to that yet, and we need their voices in democracy too. And so those young people are going to need a little bit more support this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally can.
Can I just add, one of the things that I was thinking when you were talking about how to reach young people about the importance of voting is, and it doesn't even relate to being at home versus being in school, is through the curriculum. Because I remember learning every year in school, American history and the Constitution and the Americans rebelling from the king and no taxation without representation. But I never really got a sense until I was much, much older of what that really means, whether you have any control over your own destiny and your life, or whether somebody else, be it a king or another country that colonized you, or just your government that is controlled by Wall Street, is going to make the decisions that affect my life. And it's important for me to vote just so I can participate and have some control over that.
In what you point out, there's so many civic education promising practices that can be used to teach about elections and voting, be it research skills, You know, those are skills that are needed in English language arts classes as well. There's cross-curricular uses for talking about elections and voting. It can be done in math. One of our partners, the PBS NewsHour Extra, has some amazing lesson plans that use math to teach about elections. Mm. And so this point about teaching about elections and voting in school, be it in a school building or online, is something that is such a huge opportunity this year. And there are amazing organizations that we partner with all the time who have resources that exist to do that. In fact, it's one reason why we pulled together a group called the Teaching for Democracy Alliance, specifically to help administrators and help teachers figure out, how do I teach about elections and voting in a rigorous way, in a nonpartisan way, in a way that can meet the learning outcomes that they're focused on? And there's so many really exciting ways to do that, to Arnie's point, at all levels of school.
And now, in an interesting way, because of the pandemic, because of being stuck at home, because now every issue is now being discussed, or at least being roiled around, about access to employment, about access to healthcare, about whether you're going to go to school, about what kind of job you're going to have. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is the most remarkable civics education any young person would ever want, let alone have to address at such a young age. And yet it's a wonderful opportunity to connect dots, you know, because in so many ways, every aspect of their life is being challenged or changed.
But one of the things that is difficult, right, in understanding what's happening there and translating it to elections and voting, is that one of the challenges to civic education more recently, as some of our research colleagues at other institutions have found, is that somewhat because of our partisan polarized environment, the parties, political parties and ideologies, are not taught as often as we might think. They're taught using a historical lens. And so as we, you know, think about this current issue environment translating into voting and elections, there's some support for young people who don't understand what exactly it is to be a Republican and the ideology behind that, or, you know, what it means to be liberal or the ideology around that, and how to interpret different candidates' ideology and what they stand for. Right. And so there is some discussion and some support for young people to do, even though we're in this, you know, incredible environment. And so this gets to one of the things that we always talk about when it comes to elections, which is, don't make assumptions. Don't make assumptions that, you know, just because young people use the internet for lots and lots of things, that they know that their state has online voter registration and can navigate it or want to navigate it by themselves. Or that they, you know, if they're in a state where you have to request an absentee ballot, that they know how to do that or where to go to do that. And so these are some of the things that I think are really important considerations as we think forwardly about, you know, some of the primaries that are happening in June, but also the 2020 election, and how we make sure that more young people are having, and more diverse young people are having, their voices heard.
I only have a few minutes left. So I have been challenged about the partisan issues as you approach an election, because it is about choice. Let's be honest here. And so they're always asking me about, how do I make my choices, or what do I base it on? And after all, Arnie, you're a progressive Democrat, yada, yada, yada. I do a little bit of a history lesson with them, because I come from a very conservative family. So my very conservative family did not decide for me what my political ideology was going to be. I formed that myself. I formed that through experience, through questions, through whatever. But I also reminded the young people that I talked to that I have learned a tremendous amount from people who are not from my party, that they have been some of my best teachers. And then last but not least, I also remind them that my second husband was a conservative Republican libertarian atheist who married a liberal Arnie Arneson, who he had never voted for, and I'd run for high office twice. And I said, what does that tell you? It tells you need to dialogue. It tells you can find common ground. It tells you that you don't have to make every kind of assumption about every candidate because they happen to have a party label. You need to dig deeper, just the way I dug deeper and ultimately married Marty. I said, on paper, no. In reality, I said, I do. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful to you. It is going to be a real challenge. And as you point out, 15 million young people will be eligible to vote in 2020. That's 15 million people that need to find out or understand why this is important to them, to their lives, to the lives of their families, and to their future. And I just hope that we can figure out as many ways to sort of raise our hands and wave at them and entice them and encourage them and tell them, ask me questions. And also tell parents, maybe for the first time ever, it's going to be important to you too, because you may not have exercised the franchise, but maybe this experience will tell you why voting matters to you, and then maybe you should bring your kid along. So it's going to be a very, very interesting year. Thank you so much for doing this. And again, the title of the article at The Conversation by Abby Kisa, How to Reach Young Voters When They're Stuck at Home. And I'm grateful for Tufts for having an organization like this, and they've had for 20 years. We need more organizations that care about civics, because in the end, it will sort of help us refine a better future. So thank you.
Thank you both so much.
You're welcome. Ciao. Bye. Bye-bye.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day the Occupational Safety and Health Act went into effect. At the time, it was estimated that 14,000 workers died annually on the job, 2.2 million workers were permanently or temporarily disabled, and 500,000 developed occupational diseases each year. It was estimated that at least 25 million serious injuries and deaths went unreported each year. Many of the standards, regulations, and enforcements OSHA now has have come as a result of intense, continuous pressure waged by the labor movement. The Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union was the first to test out the new bill when they filed a complaint against the Allied Chemical Company in Moundsville, West Virginia, in May of 1971. Among the many hazards at the facility, pools of mercury on the shop floor were common occurrences. OSHA issued its first citation against Allied Chemical under the General Duty Clause. The first OSHA standard issued came a year later for asbestos. Today, the AFL-CIO notes that for the year 2015, 4,836 workers were killed on the job. There is only one OSHA inspector for every 76,000 workers, and on average, it would take OSHA 145 years to inspect every workplace in the country. But new rules protecting workers from silica dust and beryllium have been established, as have strong reporting and record-keeping standards. There are stricter coal dust standards and anti-retaliation protections for workplace whistleblowers. The Trump administration is currently looking to overturn all of it. You can take action this Workers' Memorial Day to protect working conditions on the job by finding an event in your area by going to aflcio.org. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. How much do I know? But you talk out of turn. You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's the one thing I know. I'm younger than you. That even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. So I'm going to Mother Jones, and I see two articles, and I thought, God, I haven't talked about the Pentagon budget for a long time. I think it's time to get back into this conversation. Joining us right now is Dan Spinelli. He wrote two pieces. One was entitled, Senate Democrats Blast Pentagon Over Coronavirus Failure. And the other article was entitled, Progressives Want Congress to Stop Bailing Out the Pentagon During the Pandemic. So let me welcome Dan to the program. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing really well, Arnie. Thanks for having me.
So give me a little bit about Dan Spinelli's background. And obviously, this appears to be your beat. So you know quite a bit about defense contractors, the Pentagon, and you've been following sort of the exploding budget that the Pentagon seems to be having with each passing year. Both Republicans and Democrats keep going, more money, not a problem. More money, not a problem. So a little bit about Dan first.
Yeah, no, it is really a cyclical story. And it's similar things that I think we tend to see every year. But I'm relatively new to the beat. I joined Mother Jones about 2 years ago, coming up in June. And I started covering national security a little over a year ago. And one of the things I love to focus on is the interplay between the Pentagon, Congress, lobbyists, and other special interests. And that really centers on the Pentagon budget. So it's sort of an easy place for me to play out all the things that I'm interested in.
Well, and what's so sad about the Pentagon budget is that not only is it a black hole, and there is just so much money in there, it's just mind-boggling. I remember reading an article a couple of months ago about how they were rearranging through an accounting process trillions of dollars just in 1 year. I mean, they were rearranging trillions. What does that tell you about what's in there? But the other problem with the Pentagon budget is that it's not just about national security. It turns out to be like a jobs program. So a lot of US senators and members of Congress love the idea that they use the Pentagon budget as a way to bring home the bacon. So sometimes what we're realizing is that we're spending billions, if not trillions of dollars, and it's not about our national security. You know, it's about, you know, how many contracts can I bring back to Raytheon? Or how many contracts can I assure to Boeing? Or how many contracts will, you know, end up in a contractor in Georgia? And that, I think, is so problematic because in a lot of ways, the Pentagon budget turns out to be pretty dishonest.
Well, it really is sort of an equal opportunity offender. I think people tend to think of Congress, right, as extremely partisan and most of the bills passing on a party line vote. And what's funny is that the National Defense Authorization Act, which isn't actually the Pentagon budget, but is this bill that passes every year that sets the priorities for American national security strategy, it actually passes with huge bipartisan majorities. And it's very rare that there's ever a party line vote. This most recent one was actually an anomaly in that House Democrats actually stacked it with a bunch of progressive priorities. But when you look at a bill like that and you see why it is uniformly supported kind of across the aisle, it's really for the reasons that you identified. I think lawmakers are really good and making sure that their district or their state is well served by what is put in that bill.
But one of the things I think the progressives were, at least I'm so glad their voice was there, is they really talked about all the things that we are not investing in at the local city and town and state level because so much of the money, I mean, it is a sucking sound, the Pentagon. It all goes into things. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't use a B-1 bomber in my school. It doesn't necessarily feed my kids. It doesn't repair my infrastructure, but yet we're spending hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on these pieces of equipment, some of which don't even work. And yet I don't quite understand why there is this bipartisan kumbaya for decades when it's clear that we have been disinvesting in things that people value, disinvesting in things that will provide a economic security floor for a country in order to at least create the illusion that we're somehow making ourselves safer.
That really is the eternal question, right? Why have we been unable to disinvest from these legacy hardware systems, right? That
exactly.
either don't even really use that much or don't really represent the national security strategy that we need to focus on. I think one thing progressives has been pointing out for years, right, is the importance of investing in climate change, right? That the Pentagon has one of the largest carbon footprints on the planet. The Pentagon is actually a rare government agency to actually acknowledge the threat of climate change, but they usually drown it in a bunch of euphemisms because they can't necessarily try to politicize the issue given how politicized it has been. So there are so many opportunities, right, to redirect national security strategy towards things like pandemics, which we all recognize now certainly deserves a lot more attention, and climate change, and away from some of the more outdated styles of thinking about what constitutes a threat.
Well, I guess that is my big question. Maybe what the progressives need to do is not sort of trash the Pentagon, but redefine national security. That what we, I mean, I think that that's been part of the problem. It's like somehow what they do is wrong, but I think what you have to do is say, what do we mean by national security? I mean, you keep hearing it from the president. He talks about himself as being a war president. He's fighting a freaking virus. You know, he can't use a gun against it. He can't use a B-1 bomber against it. He can't nuke it. And yet he's referring to himself as a war president, and this is the enemy. Well, can't we use even Donald Trump's language as we look at this budget and say, so tell us, how are we fighting this enemy, you know, by the kinds of checks we're writing to the Pentagon? And I guess maybe that's one of the questions I have as I'm looking at this coronavirus story, because it seems to me it creates incredible opportunity to have a new discussion about how we are writing the budget for the Pentagon.
It sure does. And what's interesting is that progressives are obviously raising this point, but so are folks on the right. You know, Koch brothers backed groups have been among the loudest voices in pushing for disengagement from the Middle East and a drawdown in troops overseas. And I think that's something maybe a lot of folks don't realize, but there is a smaller minority kind of across the aisle of people who really want to radically rethink how America interacts with the world and how we fund our priorities. And what I think is interesting about Trump in particular is the tendency to sort of speak outside of both sides of his mouth when he, in some ways, expresses sort of isolationist tendencies, like when he pulled troops from northeastern Syria, which I'm sure people recall.
Yes, of course.
So that would imply that he is not really interested in kind of this Middle East aventurism that other Republican presidents have, you know, in recent history have gone for. But then he also has, you know, rapidly supported increases to the military's budget, has bragged about increasing the military's budget, and then attempted to defund a lot of programs at the State Department, right? And you would expect a president who is interested in drawing down, you know, our forces in the Middle East would perhaps want to invest in peacemaking and diplomacy and not put all of that in, you know, that focus in shiny weapons. But there is kind of that tendency, I think, for Trump to say two opposing things and kind of have you believe what you want out of it.
Could I ask a question that follows up on this and also Arnie's point earlier? It has to do with political bragging rights. When you were talking earlier, Dan, about analyzing the bills that passed for the Pentagon, NDAA, Authorization Act, being unanimous or near unanimous and totally bipartisan, I was thinking, yes, the final bills are all pretty much bipartisan because nobody wants to say that they voted against funding our military. And everybody likes to go out and brag on the hustings that, you know, I voted for a bill that increased our spending on military. Donald Trump likes to brag too. President increased budget for the military by X amount. But the question is kind of like the definition of national security that Arnie was talking about. What's in the bill? What does it actually go to? Does it go to stealth bombers, which may be not a necessary or a wise investment of money? Or does it go to something like climate change or fighting COVID-19, which is clearly a national security issue? but it isn't what we traditionally think of when we think of funding our Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. I just wondered if the way to deal with it now might not be to either directly or indirectly to do the infighting about how we redefine the spending and then let Donald Trump brag that he voted for an NDAA military authorization that was the biggest in history.
It's a good point. You know, what's interesting is a lot of the debate that has taken place on the committee level before these final, you know, these bills get finalized. Actually, this past year had a lot to do with foreign policy. So one of the more controversial amendments that was attached to the original House Democrats version of the NDAA involved restricting Trump's authority to launch a war with Iran or attack Iran without congressional approval.
Right.
There were also limits on the amount of money that the U.S. could spend on supporting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. So I think you saw the progressive focus, at least, more on kind of foreign policy issues, which some would argue are not exactly the main purview of the NDAA. Obviously, the NDAA deals with national security strategy writ large, but it does tend to occupy itself with more kind of minimal, you know, issues of Defense Department policy, not so much kind of broader, who can we attack, when can we attack type things. But what I was surprised by, at least, is, and I don't want to imply that that focus has gone away, because I assume that we'll still see those debates again when Congress is able to eventually debate next year's NDAA. But for progressives to come out and say, we, you know, do not want Congress to, you know, allocate another dollar of spending, you know, to the Pentagon during this pandemic, I think that was a much firmer line on the spending issue, on the top line spending figure, which has certainly occupied a lot of the debate among advocacy groups, but really has been steadily rising, I would say, you know, with only a few exceptions, you know, for the better part of the last two decades.
Let me want to go back to your article, because you point out in your article that the Senate, 10 Senate Democrats are blasting the Defense Department's response to the coronavirus crisis, criticizing leaders in a letter released Monday for a slow and disjointed response that left troops at risk. And I guess the question is, with a defense budget that is so enormous, bigger than all, like, how many countries combined, that not only were they knuckle-dragging when it came to addressing the coronavirus, but if security and safety is important, security and safety of your troops should be numero uno. I mean, that is like number one. And, you know, we're blaming the president for not reading anything and not preparing. I get that he's asleep at the switch. I'm trying to figure out how the hell the Pentagon can explain that they were asleep at the switch, because if nothing else, because this is an international pandemic, it's everywhere in the world, they have an obligation around the world to be concerned. And that concern could have so easily then percolated up to concern within the United States that would have forced maybe the president to have acted sooner, because they understood the consequences for their troops that are everywhere, Dan, everywhere.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was certainly quite a harsh letter.
I'm sure it was. I would have been harsh.
And, you know, I think if anything, we probably undersold how harsh it was. And the Pentagon issued its own sort of harsh response today, actually. But I think one of the key problems the senators identified was really the lack of uniformity in DOD's approach. There were some military commanders, specifically those in South Korea and Italy, who are actually praised for jumping on this issue quickly, enforcing, you know, widely respected guidelines to ensure that their troops would not be, you know, injured or infected as best as they could. And the rate of infections in some of those bases was actually much lower than one would have expected. I think the problem was it was not made uniform and had utter disasters like the situation on the USS Theodore Roosevelt.
The Navy, right.
Right. And I think just the way that Secretary of Defense Mark Esper reacted to it and kind of allowed that situation to play out, even as the captain of the ship had been writing to his superiors saying, this situation has really gotten out of control and we really need to quarantine the majority of the infected sailors on the ship to prevent, you know, further tragedies. The Pentagon did not respond quickly, and they ended up, as I'm sure you know, firing the captain, relieving him of his command.
Right.
And then doing exactly what he had recommended just later.
eventually
quarantining most of the crew members.
So Dan, you know what? So I used this sentence the other day on Facebook, and I was talking about education, but in a lot of ways it goes to how the Pentagon addressed this, and that you pointed out how effective they were in Italy and maybe Korea. And I said, you know, we have pockets of excellence and acres of mediocrity. And what you see now with the Pentagon is that that's actually true. Depending on who the commander was, there was an appropriate response. But I thought the Pentagon was good at kind of a universal picture. I thought the Pentagon was good at not just having pockets of appropriate response, but understanding that that response is something that perhaps will be impacting every troop in every state, in every country, and that there should be a sort of frontline response to be prepared to address this. The fact that it's, you know, commander specific, you know, hallelujah for some commanders, but this is the whole rationale behind the military, is that they don't just make it commander specific, they figure out how they can protect the entire institution because it's too important. You can't have weaknesses somewhere, because weaknesses somewhere become weaknesses everywhere.
It's exactly the problem. I think that...
Oh, God damn. Go on.
No. I'm sort of fascinated by the battles that Pentagon leadership chooses to pick. Like with the Theodore Roosevelt situation, which eventually blew up, there was so much discontent among from the acting Navy secretary's point of view, that this letter that the captain of the Theodore Roosevelt had written ended up being leaked. And the argument that the acting secretary put out was that the captain irresponsibly wrote this letter and CC'd too many people. Well, we later find out when the Navy does an investigation, this isn't true.
You're kidding. That's not true? Oh, Dan. Oh, my God. Make that front page Mother Jones. Oh, my God. Well, I still was, like, disabused. I thought that somehow maybe he really wanted to sort of spread it around.
No. Well,
Dan.
In all fairness, let me credit the Washington Post, who initially had this story and has done a fantastic job reporting it. But they initially found out, and you know, I want to make sure I quote this accurately.
Please do.
I believe that the Navy had suggested that there were like 20 to 30 people who were CC'd on the email. And what the Washington Post discovered was that it was demonstrably lower than that. I think it was like 6 or 7, but don't quote me on that. Read the article.
I will. I'm going to go find it. I'm going to read it out loud to my audience. You know, Dan, let me just say something. Yeah. Here is the problem. You see the explosion, but then you don't have time, because there's so much chaos going on, to find out the rest of the story. So in a lot of ways, you know, the misinformation, the 20 or 30 or whatever that number is the number that, I mean, you may love him for what he did. You may admire him, but then you figure out, well, maybe he did something. And then you find out after an investigation that doesn't happen within 24 hours. They don't put as much emphasis on the denouement as they do on the explosion. And again, that's what is so so disgusting about covering the Trump administration, covering the Secretary of Defense, covering all these things, is that you only know a tiny little piece of the story that is the most explosive, and no one ever really sort of gives you the time to understand that when they actually did the investigation, so much of it wasn't true, because it was done to protect the Department of Defense. It wasn't done to protect him. No surprise. But what is so frustrating is it just doesn't get the same kind of explosive attention.
No, it never does. I think harder maybe at any point in history to be a good news consumer, to be a responsible news consumer.
Exactly.
It's incumbent on us as journalists, right, to make that as easy as we can. But it is hard because there's so much attention on the initial issue, not so much attention on the resolution. And that is certainly a problem.
You even know how the information got out? I mean, if it wasn't what we all thought it was, namely the captain CCing everybody in the world on his complaint, if it wasn't that, then did the somebody in the Pentagon spill it or leak it in order to achieve some goal, I don't know what? Or was it just that the Washington Post had such excellent journalists that they got the one person in the Pentagon who knew about this? There are a lot of scenarios for how it got out there, some of which imply different things about what's really going on.
I will say I have no idea how it got out. The San Francisco Chronicle first reported it. And at the time, the acting secretary of the Navy made a point in his press conference justifying the firing that this was the captain's hometown newspaper. And he sort of didn't go out on a limb and necessarily say that the captain had leaked it, but he, for some reason, included this detail, right?
Yeah.
Well, when the Navy completed its investigation, and I believe the investigation was wrapped up late last week, they recommended reinstating him. Yeah. So clearly whatever this investigation found was that he was not necessarily at fault because they recommended reinstating him to his command. And the Navy has never publicly accused him of leaking it. They've just suggested that he acted in a way that could have led to it being leaked because it had been CC'd by so many people. But these reports I'm referring to, like the Washington Post one, found that it was actually, right, it was only CC'd to a few people, not 20 to 30, as the Navy had suggested. But to answer your question, while I don't know the particulars of this situation, how it got out, stuff leaks out of the Pentagon all the time. I mean, one needs to only read, you know, one of the dozens of terrific trade publications that cover defense, and you'll see it. It's not often as big as this particular story.
Right.
But classified information leaks out of the Pentagon, for God's sake. I mean, it's certainly not rare.
But some of it is leaking from somebody like Daniel Ellsberg, who thinks the public should know about some wrongdoing that's going on. And some of it leaks because the insiders want to make it fit their political agenda. You know, there are a lot of scenarios for how it got out there, some of which imply different things about what's really going on.
Well, that's true everywhere. I mean, I hate to break it to you. But before I let you go, I got to ask, you said that the Secretary of Defense wrote a snarky letter back to these 10 Senate Democrats, and that came out, I believe you said, today. So can you tell me, how did Mark Esper respond, and what did he base his snark on?
Sure, so this was attributed to the Secretary's spokesperson, who's a guy by the name of Jonathan Hoffman.
Okay.
And he said, it is unfortunate that this letter has cherry-picked false and repeatedly debunked assertions that do not reflect reality. And, you know, he goes on for a bit and you know, describes in some detail about how impossible it is for the military to have consistent standards across all these different installations. And then adds, while we are not above criticism, this letter does not even remotely accurately reflect our record of action against the coronavirus. So that was their response.
So they can't be consistent is what they're arguing.
Just that, you know, I think a charitable way to view it is that, you know, an installation in South Korea is certainly going to have different standards and different rules than one, you know, in Norfolk, Virginia.
But let me just say something. But what they're seeing, because they're, maybe they're ahead of the curve, and what they're seeing in Italy isn't just left in Italy, isn't just left in Korea. It should be sent right back to the powers that be, saying, this is happening. This is what we're seeing. This is how we're responding. What are you doing? I mean, I understand, you know, when it goes to Donald Trump, it goes into a black hole. But when it goes to the Pentagon, it should be, we're going to sprint, we're going to react, we're going to learn, we're going to institute these things. I mean, they're a different, you know, kettle of fish. And for them to talk about that they're not supposed to have consistency is an excuse to say, oh my God, we made a mistake. No?
For sure.
Oh, God, Dan Spinelli.
You look down the road a little bit. You know, it's not just fight today's fire. We see what's going on in Italy, but in 2 weeks or in a month or in 3 months, what's it going to be like in New York and California and every place in between? Do a little foresight.
Well, it appears that, once again, everyone sort of doesn't want to acknowledge they dropped the ball. And it's really hard to say, I made a mistake. And I get that, Dan. But these are kind of... It's a little bit shocking when you have an institution that so sort of props itself up with this idea of anticipation and having the gestalt view and working coordinate. I mean, of all the institutions that really doesn't have the excuse to drop the ball, I hate to break it to you. I think it's the Pentagon. And on that note, Dan Spinelli, I think I want you back. I'm not quite sure how often because I don't know if I can handle it because it just gets me so upset. But it's really important that you come back on a fairly regular basis. There's such a cacophony of news of which so much of it is not valuable. You know, it's repetition. It doesn't enlighten us. It doesn't give us the kind of information that we need at our fingertips as we look at an election in November of 2020, but also in doing the kind of analysis we need to do so that as citizens, we can express our concern and our disdain. So thank you so much for writing for Mother Jones, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Ciao. All right. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude. We'll chat tomorrow. Ciao.